Rob, when we talk about the diversity of life, there are really diverse creatures in this pool.
This one little touch tank is filled with amazing things.
So each of these kinds, from the Genesis paradigm, each of these were created, and yet there's some similarities between them.
Similarities and differences, and that's what we see across the entire realm of life, similarities and differences.
So what makes them different?
Well, genetically, they're very similar. They have the same biochemistry. They have they share most of their genes in common. But there are developmental genes, they're called Hox genes, that set up these patterns in the animal as it develops. They develop from a single cell, just like you and I do.
Mm-hmm.
But just like my left and right hand are mirror images of one another,
yeah.
It's because there are genes that set up inside of me that did patterns and sequences and timing, such to the point where as I grew my little arm buds, my hands popped out and they look almost the same. Well, for these guys, there are Hox genes. That in one of them, they set up a 5-fold symmetry. Another, they set up a 10-fold symmetry. Another one, they make this long, skinny animal. There are these master computer programs that have a tremendous downstream effect. They control the development of the embryo in these amazing ways.
So it's like we have these programs that are creating all this diversity, but there is a master program, almost like an operating system.
Absolutely. That operating system, actually, scientists have compared the operating system of a simple bacterium to the Linux operating system.
Which is very, very complex.
Very complex, but when we look at it, there's a lot of computer programming in life.
Huh.
And so what we've seen is just like in our operating systems, life has some master modules and then has some middle-level programs that control all the output. We call that proteins and sugars and action. Computer systems, they've got your operating system that controls a lot of middle-level managers, you know, do this to the sound card, do this to video card, that controls all the outputs. But it's really funny, when we look at the way life is structured, it's a lot more optimally designed. You have less high-level programs controlling less middle-level programs controlling a lot more outputs. Our computer programs are top-heavy.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of stuff up here controlling a little bit of stuff down here because we're not quite as smart as God.
Mm-hmm. So what you're saying, when we look at this from a molecular or genetic perspective, what we're finding is really a fascinating design in all of that.
Absolutely. And when you talk about the standard paradigm, the standard evolutionary story, we run into great difficulties when we get to these Hox genes, to these master program modules. Because, yeah, you can take a starfish like that and you can change its size a little bit. You might change its color a little bit. But if you want to get that starfish to turn into a radically different organism, you don't tweak these little things. You have to tweak the high-level operating system. And that usually causes a downstream catastrophe. I mean, imagine if you're programming a computer, right? You can change a 1 or a 0 in an output, and maybe now your letters are blue instead of white on the screen. Big deal. But if you wanted to randomly change the core operating system, how many changes are possible that don't cause disaster? I mean, almost all changes would ruin the whole system.
From a computer scientist perspective, I can tell you, we call that system software sometimes. That's the fundamental heart of that whole system. You have a problem down there, the whole thing breaks down.
And when someone wants to change that, how many people have to think for how long to make a simple change to the basic programming?
That's tough, because once you start monkeying with that operating system, with that system software, you have to be very careful because you'll upset the whole thing.
Yeah, and that's what we see in life.
But what we've heard in the conventional paradigm, the conventional story tells us that it's those random changes that has brought about all of this.
Sure. Back in the 1800s, when life was simple, when they didn't know what was happening inside the cell, didn't know how complex genetics was, you could imagine all sorts of things. I mean, you could imagine a cell turning into a square or a circle or changing color or growing a spike or a hair. No problem. But now that we know what actually happens behind the scenes, the story gets a lot more complicated. You see, the more complex life becomes, the less impossible evolutionary theory becomes. Mm-hmm. It can only work if life is really, really simple, and life is not simple. Mm-hmm. We've had a revolution in technology just the last 10 or 15 years that our understanding of life has skyrocketed, and the standard paradigm's ability to explain life has plummeted. Huh.
So this is that concept of a black box. Like Darwin really couldn't see inside that, and so he thought it was simple. But what you're saying is that now we're finding it's extremely complex.
Yes, and it's complex at all levels. I mean, structurally it's complex, functionally it's complex, biochemistry is unbelievably complex, genetics is, our understanding of genetics is only getting more complex over time. Hmm.
What are we finding now as we're studying genetics? What are kind of the things that we see now that we didn't see 50 years ago?
Well, 50 years ago, they had this simple idea that you have a gene and a gene makes a protein. That's been blown out of the water. We now know that genes are involved in making dozens, if not hundreds of proteins, and different pieces of genes are used in different proteins at different times in the cell cycle, different times in life, under different conditions, in different cells. Most of your cells in your body, they produce similar proteins than other cells, but they're different. Huh. So your brain cells actually produce different versions of proteins than your liver cells produce.
So how's that possible? I mean, how do they do that?
It's dynamic programming. Hmm. You have a gene, and this piece is used over here or over there or over there. And there's little teeny programs inside the DNA that control when and where and how to use that piece. Mm-hmm. But just recently I read a paper about actually shifting of the information in the genes. So if you start at letter number one, you can read out this information. If you start at letter number two, you get a totally different information. How on earth did that evolve like that? I mean, if you think of, if you read a story, maybe you're reading a story talking about some swashbuckling pirate. Mm-hmm. But if you start a second letter, it's a chocolate chip cookie recipe. We can't write that. There's no way we could intelligently program multiple levels of information into the same story. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see in life. And if we can't do it intelligently, it's not going to happen randomly.
We're talking about something that is beyond imagination in terms of the complexity. Yeah. Even from the standpoint of the kind of things we've done with software, and we've done some amazing things with software, but that appears to be is not even close to what you're talking about.
I like to say the genome is four-dimensional. Hmm. In software, we write in lines of code.
Correct.
Well, in mathematics, we learned a line is a one-dimensional object. It just has length. Mm-hmm. So you could actually take a computer program and just write from left to right for millions of characters. Now, on our screens, we put carriage returns in there so we can read it. But the computer doesn't know that. It ignores the carriage returns. It's just a line. Well, DNA is a line. So in the naive concept of DNA, we had a line that had information in it. Mm-hmm. But it's not simple like that. Because this piece of DNA makes a little protein that comes over here and sticks on this piece of DNA over here, which turns on or turns off a gene.
Oh my goodness, it's like self-modifying code.
Oh, it's worse than that. Because this piece of DNA over here makes just an RNA that goes over here and interferes with this gene's RNA. They stick together, they interfere, they conflict with one another, they turn things on, they turn things off. And if you want to draw that out, you would need a sheet of paper, a very big sheet of paper. You'd have to write all the letters of DNA out on all 3 billion of them. It would take, I calculated, about 850 Bibles as one human genome. And then you have to draw lines or arrows from one part to another part because this part turns this part off, this part interferes with this, this part enhances this. It's this huge two-dimensional interaction network. And that's where you have a two-dimensional genome.
So it sounds like, I mean, let me stop here a second because this is really amazing to think about this because I think, in terms of a computer program, that it's fairly static. I mean, the instructions are there. But you're talking about a program that is reprogramming itself, that's modifying its own instructions.
Oh, wait till I get to the fourth dimension.
Oh, okay.
It's because of the third dimension first. The genome also folds into a three-dimensional shape. And so it's a 3D, the third dimension, is actually the shape. And the genes that are buried inside this ball of DNA, they're not active. They're turned off. The genes that are exposed are the ones that are used. So whoever programmed that string knew when it folded up which genes will be available at what time.
I say, are you saying that when this instruction set folds onto itself, it creates a whole new set of instructions?
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's mind-boggling.
The information in that first dimension, that linear string, has to be organized in such a way that when it folds into the third dimension, it still works.
Oh, well, that's amazing.
But it's amazing. When they first sequenced the human genome, some scientists sat down, they did something I would have done. They said, okay, let's look at genes that we know are used in a biochemical pathway. They might like 10 genes in a row to convert this into something over here. Well, if I was programmed it, I would have stuck them right next to each other in the genome. So they looked, and they weren't next to each other. They're random. They said, these genes are used on different chromosomes, they're backwards, they're forwards, they said, look at all the evidence of evolution, it's just junk. Random changes over millions of years, throw all this stuff together willy-nilly, it's just nonsense.
And we've heard that a lot.
We've heard that a whole lot.
Junk DNA.
Yes, but then someone figured out how to look at the genome in three dimensions. First of all, they realized the genome folds in a fractal pattern. And it's beautiful. But it's in a fractal pattern that doesn't make knots. And so it folds up, and then when they figured out where the genes were, genes that are used together are next to each other in 3D space. Even if they're on different chromosomes, when the chromosomes fold, they bring those two genes next to each other, and usually this cluster of genes is right next to a nuclear pore. So when God programmed these genes, he knew that when he had to turn all these genes on, he needed them in three-dimensional space next to each other. So the whole biochemical pathway can be turned on. The little things are copied into RNA. The RNA comes outside the nucleus, is turned into protein. Voila.
Oh, that's amazing. Okay, so you've about blown my mind with that, but you said there's another dimension here.
Oh, yeah. The fourth dimension is time.
And how does that work?
The genome changes shape over time. Remember I said the genes, some genes are buried
yes.
and some are exposed? Well, you need those buried genes at some time. And so at different stages of development, or sleeping versus waking, or stress versus non-stress, or after maybe you eat something that's bad for you, and your liver says, I can get rid of that toxin. Now, your earlobes, they don't care. They don't know what to do, but your liver says, I know what to do. The chromosomes in the liver will change shape. Expose that new protein gene, make copies of it, build a brand new protein that can kill off that toxin, and when it's not needed anymore, they'll change shape again and fold back.
Oh my goodness. So what you're saying is that we could look at this, I mean, from a very simple perspective, and come up with the phrase called junk DNA.
Yes.
And then we can even look at it when it's folded, even though that is complex, and say, oh, there's still some strange things in there. But you're saying, if it's not being used, we might not recognize its importance.
True.
Until it is.
But some of the information in the genome is like scaffolding in the building. The reason this piece of DNA is here is because when it folds into the three dimensions, it needs these two genes to be next to each other.
Right.
So this stretch here might not have a functional protein associated with it, but it still has a function. It's very important. So most of the so-called junk DNA has been brought into the functional category, just not in the way the standard paradigm predicted. And it's funny because the more amazing, the more complex things become, the harder it is for the standard paradigm to explain it. That three-dimensional ball of DNA changes over the fourth dimension. But the interaction networks in that second dimension, they change. Because this gene turns off, well, that affects this one over here. This one no longer talks to that one over there. But it's even more complicated than that. It's the first dimension, that linear string, the program changes. The computer software people, they don't like programs that dynamically rewrite themselves. You get all sorts of catastrophe, but we've learned that in the human brain cells have different genomes to other brain cells. There are these little pieces of DNA that they make a circle and they pop out and they go over and they float somewhere else in the genome and they stick themselves in there and they turn genes on and they turn genes off. And now we have different pieces of DNA in different brain cells, and that directs what type of brain cell it will become. But our liver cells, they have different genomes also. There's a lot of chromosomal duplications that happen in the liver. Because if you need a biochemical pathway and a lot of it, well, make extra copies of those protein genes. But different liver cells have different copies of different chromosomes. And we've learned that in the mouse embryo, there's a jumping gene, a junk piece of DNA, an ancient viral infection, the standard paradigm says, which is balderdash. Not true. Because this little piece of DNA has to excise itself and jump around in the mouse embryo to turn genes on and turn genes off. And if you deactivate that little piece of DNA, you don't get development. It stops. So it's necessary in the mouse. It's probably something similar also probably happens in us. Dynamic programming. All three levels change in the fourth level, time.
Rob, that's so far beyond anything that we know, even in our most complex software systems, that it's almost beyond imagination to think that someone would look at that and say it all happened by chance.
Yes, and it only brings glory to God.
It does.
Because the more complex it becomes, the less possible it is to explain with natural, simple mutational processes. And we realize that God is so far above us in intelligence. We don't program computers like that because we're not that smart. But He made us in His image. We're good at copying things. I predict that computers in the future are going to be different because of what we're learning in the genome.
Well, we've done that in the past, and we were talking earlier about how man has looked at the flight of birds and studied them aerodynamically, and from that we've been able to create aircraft.
Yes.
But it's hard for me right now to think that what you're talking about, that we could even come close to replicating.
Not yet. Not with any technology we have right now. We are limited to silicon chips right now, and that is so incredibly primitive compared to the technology that God engineered directly into life.
Rob, there's a complexity here that is just hard to imagine, hard to even get your mind around. And yet, the conventional paradigm would tell us that all of this happened as a result of random processes over billions of years. But that's hard to imagine that that could happen.
It is becoming impossible to imagine based on what we're learning, but all different levels of life. I mean, the genome, you can't build something like that up one thing at a time. You need it to function. In all this interlocking four-dimensional complexity, it's not something you can do one letter at a time with natural selection.
It all has to be there.
Yeah, in the same way when we talk about the environment out here on the coral reef, if you don't have all these interlocking pieces of that puzzle, you don't have that ecology. The system will come crashing down if you just remove a couple of very important factors that are there. They have to be together or it doesn't happen.
So not only did we have this interdependency, this mutualism, so to speak, down at the genetic level, now we even make it more complex by saying there is that same mutualism at the higher level as well.
Yes. In fact, the entire world has a mutualism. Think about it. Everything on Earth depends upon photosynthesis. Mm-hmm. Everything depends upon plants grabbing sunlight, storing that energy in sugar molecules. If that didn't exist, nothing else would exist.
Mm-hmm. So we're back to this notion, to some extent, of this, the fact that the whole creation itself is built in relationships with each other. It's all interconnected. There are relationships between pieces that we haven't even been able to see and think about.
And yet we're continually discovering
them. And we're discovering them.
There are some who would turn at this point to Gaia, or the universe being conscious or alive. It doesn't fly because they're still appealing to this conventional millions of years paradigm, and they're still trying to build it up step by step. It doesn't work that way. You cannot build high technology step by step.
Right.
It takes a leap of technology to produce something like a starfish.
Right.
From nothing.
Rob, what you're saying here is that it's impossible to think that all of this could have happened just by a series of slow processes over billions of years.
That's exactly what I'm saying. When we talk about the cell, we have to talk about technology. When we talk about technology, we have to talk about intelligence. When we look at the mutual interdependence of everything that's happening inside the cell, we realize systems like that don't come about through a stepwise process. You've got things that have to exist or life cannot exist. And they're intrinsic and important and found throughout all of life. It has to be not built up stepwise, but the whole system laid out, spun up, and then God let go.
Yeah.
And there it works.
Wow. Rob, I have to ask you this question then. We are accused often of just taking a leap of faith here in believing the Genesis paradigm. Do you think it's a leap of faith for what you believe?
There is certainly an aspect of faith involved in any science. I put my faith in my Redeemer, Jesus Christ. I put my faith in my God. But at the same time, when I'm looking at the world, my world is fitting in with what I read about God and about creation in the Bible. I don't have a gigantic scientific conflict. I'm not turning my mind off. I'm actually thinking through these things, and my colleagues, we are thinking through these issues. And it is a wonderful place to be right now. Because right now, with the technology that we're developing and the understanding that we're experiencing, it is only pointing toward our Creator.
That, I think, is a 286. I started my doctoral dissertation on a 286 machine.
Is that right?
Yeah.
You did your doctorate in philosophy of science.
Yeah, in evolutionary theory. Yeah. And the early chapters were written on a machine like that.
Well, that's interesting because you studied the whole notion of evolutionary theory, and yet a lot of people will use that word in terms of what has happened in this explosion of computer technology, that they refer to it as evolution.
You use evolution in that sense, it's really a misnomer, because biological evolution is driven fundamentally by randomness. Mistakes in DNA, mutations. This is driven by intellect, by mind, by creative intelligence. Mm-hmm. So really you're taking the same word, but you're applying it to two fundamentally different processes.
Oh, this is the Cray supercomputer.
Wow.
Seymour Cray was the engineer, the designer who did all this. He was an amazing guy. That's why they've got his picture everywhere here.
Look at that wiring. Wow.
I think there were like 60 miles of wire in that thing.
Oh, I can believe it.
I mean, he designed all of these. Like, he's really the father of what we call supercomputers.
None of this would exist without his creative intelligence.
Look at that. I mean, it's almost beautiful, the wiring.
You know, in a strange way, or maybe not a strange way, it brings to mind the circuitry we have up here.
Oh, yeah.
The density of connections. Uh-huh. And his genius, part of it was to figure out a way to cool all that so that it could function, meaning this has to be cooled as well.
That's exactly right.
Same principles, although at this level, vastly more sophisticated.
The supercomputers really weren't super from the standpoint of, like, we think of Superman that can do all kinds of stuff. Basically, the supercomputer was after speed.
Right.
It does the same simple computations that any other computer does. It just does them at a very, very rapid pace. I think the Cray was somewhere up around 160 megaflops. You know, that's a million floating point operations per second. I mean, that's really, really fast. And the faster you went, the more you needed cooling.
Yeah, but, you know, while I admire the engineering that goes into it, really, in essence, it's still a calculator, right?
That's
it's
exactly
calculating.
Right.
You compare these machines to a cell. A cell's calculating. But a cell is maintaining itself out of equilibrium with its environment by converting raw materials into products it can use. It's storing and transferring information. It's selectively transporting across its barrier between itself and the rest of the environment. It's making copies of itself. So here's your engineering challenge. Build me a supercomputer that has a compartment where it builds supercomputers, okay?
Yeah.
You'd be at that task a long time. So if you're thinking about relative degrees of complexity and engineering prowess, I would put a single E. coli bacterial cell up against anything in this room, and an E. coli would come out the clear winner. In real time, it is assessing its environment, taking in raw materials, putting out waste, doing things that these machines, as elegant and powerful as they are, they're basically souped-up calculators, right? And without a power supply, they're props. They're sitting here inert.
Exactly right. I think the original Cray required like 115 kilowatts of power. That's the power for 100 homes. And yet, what you're saying is that Cray, I think the original memory was like 32 megabytes.
Yeah.
And remember, we had 32 gigabytes. So that original Cray supercomputer is nothing. And yet, you're saying all of that is almost infinitesimally small compared to the biological systems that we have.
Tell you what, give me a flask with a nutrient medium, some sugars and things like that. I'll put in one E. coli cell, boom. On a 20-minute cycle, I'll come back in a day. There'll be millions of cells in that solution because they're doing something that nothing in this room can do, and that's reproduction. A process of such sophistication and engineering that we will be working a long time, maybe never, to build something, you know,
similar to that.
So, again, I admire what went into building these machines, but we need to recognize that what we have in living things is many orders of magnitude more sophisticated, elegant, and powerful than what clearly took genius to build.
Yes, yeah. Paul, obviously, when we look at these supercomputers, there is an exquisite design there.
Right.
And there's a lot of order there. And points us back to an obvious intelligent designer. And the intelligent design is that aspect of the historic Genesis paradigm. And you spent a lot of time looking at that.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, you think about what we have in this room. We have devices for calculating very, very fast, but that is a tiny part of physical reality. Imagine you have to design a planet, a functioning planet, that's going to be populated with millions of diverse species that will need to interrelate. And as you begin to sort of total up your engineering parameters, if you will, you're going to need an intellect able to visualize all kinds of constraints and demands that have to be jointly satisfied to have a functioning planet at all. So scale up the problem. As we scale up from supercomputer to cell, from cell to species, from species to ecosystem, from ecosystem to planetary system, the number of parameters begins to explode, and you can see that the cause that you need would have to be a super intelligence of an order that we really can't even begin to grasp. We just know it needs to be a mind. It needs to be an intelligence. So basic rationality, I think, underwrites the inference that a paradigm that's going to explain the origin of the planet that we inhabit and all of its life in a solar system where the position of the Earth is just where it needs to be to have water, for instance, in all three phases, given our distance from the sun and so forth. That's going to be an engineering task of the first order. And your paradigm that's intending to answer that question of origins is going to have to handle more than just where did the planet come from? Or, you know, how was the sun formed? No, you're going to have to deal with the information in every living thing. What was the origin of that? That incompressible DNA code, where you can't get it from an algorithm. If you want the DNA sequence for a single protein, you need the whole sequence. That's a lot of information. And for any functioning cell that we know, you're going to have on the order of 350 separate proteins, a whole lot of RNA and so forth. The problem just explodes. But you never want to let go of rationality. You want to hang on to that. And I think the rational thing to infer from everything that we observe in the living world is whatever the cause was had to be a mind and a powerful, omniscient mind.
Yeah.
That sounds a lot like God.
That brings us back to the comparison we were doing in the beginning about these two paradigms. And the conventional paradigm is one that says that all of this grew out slowly, it developed slowly over a long period of time. Well, right. I know enough to say that that cray would not work until everything was brought together. Not only from the hardware standpoint, if you just have the hardware and no software, it's just a piece of metal.
Yep.
You have to have this, the development of the software, the development of all the hardware, and bring them together, and they have to work together. That's what we're talking about in the historical genesis paradigm, are we not? That
yeah.
things have to be fully functional?
You know, you're right. And in fact, you can see this in an experiment that was done recently by Craig Venter, who was synthesizing from scratch a DNA molecule to bootstrap a cell into existence. And they inserted this DNA strand about a million base pairs long into a membrane, and it wouldn't work. So they went back and checked. There was a single mistake. So 999,999 base pairs were right. One was wrong. It was in an essential protein, and the cells wouldn't function. Mm. They were dead as a doornail. So you can be arbitrarily close to a functioning cell, and yet it's dead until everything is right. What that tells you is that for a single cell, you've got to have all the components necessary for function jointly present. But a cell doesn't exist on its own. You think about an ecosystem, it has multiple interrelated components, all of them necessary for that ecosystem as a whole to function. And again, take that out to the scale of a planet. It seems to me you can make a powerful case that to have a functioning planet at all, a functioning planet that can sustain life, mm-hmm. there are countless independent components that need to be present jointly at the same slice in time. And that, to me, would require really simultaneous design,
mm-hmm.
bringing the whole thing together in a state where it works.
Yeah. That brings us to the notion that a paradigm is not just a small little picture of reality. It's a paradigm of all of reality, and it seems it needs to explain all of reality, at least to a great extent. Is that true?
Yes. If you're dealing with the historical question of the origin of the universe and the origin of everything in the universe, including life and you and me, that's an ambitious program. And you're going to need a model, an account, a paradigm that deals with every single detail. If it's implausible to look around this room or this whole museum and say that this could have come about without intelligence, how much more would that be the case for the planet that we inhabit and the living things that populate this planet? Mm-hmm. Basic rationality guides you. In fact, it leads you to that inference, to that conclusion of intelligent design. And that would be really the only rational answer were it not that we have this competing, let's call it conventional paradigm that says, no, you've got to explain with strictly physical processes.
Mm-hmm. Paul, what you're saying is that the entire universe appears to be exquisitely engineered and designed for the purpose of life.
Right, right. And what that means then is the task of science is to understand that engineering. How does it work? How are all the parts interrelated? Nothing in this building would make any sense without the creative intelligence that went into building these machines. I want to bring people to a microscope to see a single bacterial cell and have them apply the same logic.
Mm-hmm. Paul, when we look at these two paradigms and we see how radically different they are, yet we know that there are some people who will take one of these aspects of the conventional paradigm, evolution, for example, and try to fit it into a Genesis paradigm. How do you see that?
Well, if I can paraphrase scripture, no one can serve two masters. If you really understand evolutionary theory as it's taught today, it has an essential element of randomness. It's built right into the theory. So an evolutionary biologist will say, when life first began, no one could have expected that 3.5 billion years later, Homo sapiens would appear on this planet. The Bible tells us God knows every hair on our heads. He knows when we're going to be born, what we're going to be like, our destiny, and so forth. So you're taking a process of essential randomness and trying to marry it to a God who knows every event beforehand. really, these ideas don't want to live together because at their base, they are essentially different views of the universe, different views of reality.
Mm-hmm. But I know that there are people who hold these positions, and I think they would say, but science has proven that evolution is true. Therefore, I have to hang on to that under my view of Scripture.
Right. Well, my understanding of that is quite different. I think science, far from having shown that evolution is true, in fact, has actually revealed many of its shortcomings. And I see no reason to marry the Christian worldview or theism to a failing scientific theory. Get a better theory. Work with a better theory that incorporates the reality of design. The attempt to try to synthesize fundamentally incompatible ideas is doomed to failure. And what happens in practice, I have found, is that the evolutionary or conventional paradigm comes to dominate and gradually extinguishes every theistic aspect of the creation or Genesis paradigm.
But Paul, you actually think that the conventional paradigm is dying to some extent. Would you say it's a shift going on?
Well, I think the conventional paradigm really has run its course. From Darwin's day to the present, the number of puzzles that have accumulated just within biology, which is the science I know best, have really forced evolution to a point of crisis. What keeps it in place, in terms of the culture at large, isn't so much the power of the theory as its philosophical foundation.
So from your perspective, you're saying that the increased scientific evidence that's coming in is not leaning towards a conventional paradigm.
No, I think the evidence that we have today calls for intelligent design. Let me give you a specific example. At the time of Darwin, cells were thought to be little bags of protoplasm, right? This kind of living jelly. In fact, the term protoplasm was coined at about the time of Darwin's Origin of Species. And Darwin thought, you know, get some elements under the right circumstances in what he called a warm little pond, zap it with energy, a cell might form. Okay, that's the middle of the 19th century. What's happened since then is unassisted chemistry has been kind of bouncing along here where it was in the 19th century, but the target to be explained, an actual cell, is out of sight in a different universe. The complexity of a single cell is nowhere in the neighborhood of unassisted chemistry. What's happened? 150 years of accumulating knowledge about cell biology, about information, about what it means to be alive, means that the target of explanation is now way out of sight. In a situation like that, you have to change how you think about the world. Science doesn't stand still. We know a great deal more today. And what we know indicates if you want a cell, if you want a living thing at all, you're going to need the kind of cause that can give you information, multiple integrated systems, all at the same moment in time. That looks a lot like a designing creative mind.
It seems to me that what we're saying then is that the Genesis paradigm, the historical Genesis paradigm that uses the history plus the science, is now proving to be a much better paradigm.
I think it's more adequate to the task, it's more powerful, and it, frankly, it gives you greater freedom to investigate the world in light of everything that could have happened. And if the evidence calls for a cause that can bring a planet into existence, already populated with organisms, a functioning biota, a functioning global ecosphere, which I think you need. I think the evidence indicates you need that for any life at all. You've got the freedom to call on that kind of cause. That's not going to be a physical process. That's going to be a transcendent, powerful intellect with creativity and humor. I mean, the cause that made the panda bear has got a sense of humor, let's be honest.
Paul, it's obvious that this excites you, this whole area invigorates you. Why?
Well, I think that science is a tool that God has given us to understand his world, to control it for our own benefit, and I think that it certainly does that. But really, it is the servant of our worldviews. And it's beautiful, it's powerful, but it's only one aspect of reality. And I'll be honest with you, if I had a single book to take with me to a desert island, it wouldn't be a biology textbook. Biology is something we do for ourselves. I cannot for myself come up with Psalm 23 or Psalm 104, which is really a hymn of praise to God's creative power and majesty, or the last four chapters of Job, where, you know, God sort of, he levels with Job. He says, look, you're not in the universe making business, all right? Yeah. That's what I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Job says, all right, I shut up, you know? Yeah. So science is beautiful, it's powerful, it's filled with creativity, it's something wonderful, but it needs to take its place in the full range of human understanding as just part of what we know, just part of what we know.